So thanks for coming and sticking around. This is our Women in Baseball committee meeting, and we have a guest speaker, and that's going to be our primary part of our meeting. But I do have just a few things that I wanted to update you on, make you aware of, and then I'm going to turn it over to our speaker, because that's what I know I'm looking forward to hearing. And so for those that don't know me, I'm Leslie Heafy. In addition to being vice president of the board, I'm also the chair of the Women in Baseball Committee, so welcome. Mostly, I just want to give you a few updates, and I'm happy to then chat with people afterwards, and if we have time at the end, we will take questions, things like that. First, I wanted to let you know that our Dorothy Seymour Mills Lifetime Achievement Award, next week we will be announcing the five finalists for that award, and we promised Jacob that we wouldn't give them to him this week, so he didn't have that to put up on. And we wanted to make sure that it didn't get overshadowed by all the great things going on the website right now. So those will come out next week, and then we will announce the winner at the Women in Baseball Conference in September, the weekend of September 16th to 18th. It's the co-sponsored conference between Sabre and the IWBC. And this year, though we originally planned to do it in person, it has shifted to a virtual conference, and so if you were not aware of that, and that hopefully makes a difference in your attending, we'll also be announcing the full schedule for that next week. But I can tell you we've got an umpires panel. We have a panel on women's baseball research and the future of that from a variety of areas. We have a baseball journeys panel. We're doing a Title IX approach with a Maybelle Blair, if you are familiar with Maybelle and you've seen her a lot on TV, Maybelle is going to be there with Justine Siegel and a current day player from, and so looking at sort of the past, present, future idea. So that's September 16th to the 18th. If you have been paying attention in This Week in Sabre and on the website, you saw the announcement of our scholarship winner from our committee, and that was Morgan Haupt. I still have to give Jacob the actual essay to put up because I gave him the bio and I forgot the essay, so you'll get to read that particular piece. And then once we get started, I have a card here that I'm going to pass around to ask people to sign. Many of you know Jean Ardell, and Jean was recovering from surgery, and so we want to send her good wishes. So I have a card to pass around and get it back to me at the end, and I'll give it back to Steve Gitcher. So thank you for that, Steve, making sure that we can send good wishes to Jean. And then if you didn't see yet League of Their Own, dropped on Friday, all eight episodes. How many have seen any of it yet? And react. Which one? Oh, sure. Yep. Awesome. Awesome. Well, cool. Well, I have to say I had the really, really cool experience of going out for the, not a red carpet premiere, because it was a baseball movie, so they did a green carpet premiere with a home plate as the backdrop. So it was very cool. And so if you haven't had a chance to see it, highly encourage it. All eight episodes are out. They're hoping that if it gets a good enough reaction, we will see the Amazon picking up season two. So there is a season two in the works for that one. And so we're hoping that that will happen. The only other piece of business, and then I'm going to introduce Melissa and turn it over to her. I also wanted to throw this out there, and anybody can come chat with me. Hopefully this will interest more than one of you. But our committee and I am in need of a co-chair. And so you can come talk to me about what that might mean, how we might, what ideas we might have. But if anybody is interested in stepping up and serving in another role within this committee, that would be awesome. And so just want to throw it out there and let you think. There's a lot of different things we could be doing and should be doing. And so that is something that I am looking for the committee. So that said, we have a guest today, and great pleasure to introduce Melissa Lidke, award-winning journalist, worked at Sports Illustrated, Time, editor of the Nieman Reports at Harvard University's Nieman Foundation for Journalism. She has had a lifelong engagement with issues revolving around girls and women's lives, led to two books, On Our Own, Unmarried Motherhood in America, Touching Home in China in Search of Missing Girlhood, and is currently working on her memoir. It's a locker room talk, a woman's struggle to get inside, reflecting on the federal lawsuit Ludke versus Kuhn, which in 1978 secured equal access for women sports reporters. They could interview players now in the locker rooms the same way that men could. Graduate of Wellesley College, recipient of a number of prestigious fellowships and awards. Just a couple of examples. In 2010, received the Yankee Quill Award for Lifetime Achievement, which is described as the highest individual honor bestowed on journalists in all of New England. While a reporter at Sports Illustrated, Newman's Club of New York presented her with its Front Page Award for her TV and radio columns about networks hiring of women sports broadcasters. Association of Women in Sports Media has presented her with the Mary Garber Pioneer Award, its Friends of the Association of Women Sports Media Awards, co-winner of the Unity Award in Media, and the list goes on and on. And so, great pleasure today. She's going to be talking to us and presenting Moms and Daughters Baseball Equality and talking about the case and what has come from that and her experience. So with that said, I'm going to turn it over to Melissa.
Thank you so much, Leslie. And I came to be connected with Leslie because of a single phone call I made to Sabre when I was thinking about coming to this conference. And I got in touch with Scott, and the next thing I knew, Scott had put our emails together, Leslie and me, and then the next thing I knew is that Leslie had invited me to come and do this talk that I'm about to do now as part of her meeting. So I feel like I stole your opportunity to do the meeting, but I'm delighted that you gave me this opportunity, and also I'm delighted to say I'm a first-time attendee for Sabre. I doubt that it will be my last, but it's one of those things that I discovered, again, a little bit late in life. David Krell, who did the magnificent talk earlier this morning, happened to call me for a book he's researching in the year 1966. And it turns out that in that year, and you'll meet her a little bit later in my talk, the woman who randomly, from a spin of a wooden box, became the judge in my federal case in the Southern District Court of New York, was put on that bench in 1966 by Lyndon Baines Johnson. And when he did that, he made history, as Ketanji Brown Jackson has reminded us. She became the first African-American woman in our nation's history appointed to the federal bench. And she became, through that random lottery, the judge who decided my case. So I'll tell you a little bit about the story, but that will give you a little sense of an introduction to who she is. And I was just really pleased to both see, Eve, Nicole, Lisa, Jennifer. They look so young. and they also just make me so proud that, the wheel keeps spinning and more women keep showing up in just these places that in my day, which I know that I think it was Lisa who referred to the 80s as though it was the Neolithic, kind of period. But all I was thinking was, well, there were the 70s, before the 80s. And I'm here to tell you a little bit about what the 70s was all about. I have talked about this talk as one that I call Mother and Daughters Baseball Inequality. And here's why I start with the quote that I do. You'll see here a quote from really one of my favorite poets, a man named Donald Hall, who in 1984 wrote a book called Fathers Playing Catch with Sons, or rather it was an essay. And you'll see that I've highlighted in red how often he talks about that combination of fathers and sons. So baseball is fathers and sons, he declares. The generations looping backward forever with a million apparitions of sticks and balls. Baseball is fathers and sons playing catch, lazy and murderous, wild and controlled. The profound, archaic song of birth, growth, age, and death. You know baseball is poetic, right? So let's go there first. We've already heard, which has been great, to hear some of the names of people I already had in my slideshow. Here is the night that Alyssa Nakin became the first female coach to ever appear on the field in a game. And you can see the first baseman coming out to congratulate her, recognizing that this was, in fact, a historic moment. We've heard earlier about Kim Ng, and we haven't heard necessarily, as but many of you likely know, that it took her close to four decades to come to where she came, which is to be a general manager in baseball and to be the first. I think we can both celebrate her accomplishment, but also ask, why did it take so long? We also have, as we mentioned earlier, and I just loved hearing these names come up in the earlier panel, Rachel Valkovic, who is with the New York Yankees and a manager of one of their minor league teams. So I'm just giving you a sense of where we are today, though a lot of you probably know this, but, you know, heck, it's fun to kind of see it happen. Here, and I have to say that you saw that my mother was a Red Sox fan in the 40s, and I have to tell you that I am also a Red Sox fan. That's one of the things that came along with growing up in the family that I did. And I also continue to live in Cambridge, Massachusetts, so I'm just a red line away from Fenway Park. So here are two young women who, as the Boston Globe said this year, are pioneering coaches for the Red Sox, Bianca Smith and Katie Krall. And it's just great to see the Red Sox finally becoming a team that is at least in the mix of doing things in advance of other teams. They took too long to integrate their baseball team, and now at least it's it warms my heart a bit to see this happening now instead of like 10 years from now. But I also want to point to the women who are covering the game. I mean, that's really the role that I played. And when I covered baseball, I was the only one covering the baseball as a national reporter. My former colleague at Sports Illustrated, whose job I took when she left for the San Francisco Examiner, Stephanie Salter, was covering the A's and the Giants out in California. But in terms of a national reporter, I was the only one. It was a bit lonely. It was challenging, as you'll hear a little later on. But here today, we see that women are now official scorers. And also, I just want to say, this was the 1970s when I was there. We're now almost 50 years later, and women just now are becoming official scorers. Again, it's a sense of, yes, we have to be patient, but we can also ask, why did it take so long? I mean, I taught my daughter how to score a baseball game when she was 8 years old. So, you know, it isn't, as they say, rocket science. We also have, as has been pointed out earlier, women playing the game. Of course, there is Kelsey Whitmore. And then I have below here a woman named Genevieve Beacon, who is one of the top Australian Baseball League players. So this is not only in America, but also internationally. And then let's go back to my chosen profession. And it was been a long, long time since we went from women entering it through the print era of my era to really feeling as though we could get to a point where women could sit in a broadcast booth, Jessica Mendoza being the first, and that was only 6 years ago. Since then, I shouldn't say that. That's in the broadcast booth, meaning TV, but of course my great, great dear friend Susan Waldman has been up at the Yankees, and she's, I now believe, in her 15th or 16th season. I meant to look it up. But we should never forget Susan, because she was really a trailblazer in radio. And, of course, here in Baltimore, you have Melanie Newman. So congratulations to all of you for that. And I think that's just absolutely wonderful. So you had last year, the first all-female broadcast crew in Major League Baseball history calls the game with, again, Melanie Newman there. Sarah Langs is the analyst, the on-field reporter, Alana Rizzo, and pregame and postgame hosts Heidi Watney and Lauren Gardner. Okay, so that's 2002. Let's now take a walk down memory lane and take us back to 1978. So that's what my story here is. And I think what you're going to see is a common refrain through this. Everyone was trying to figure out what you meant by equal back then, and we'll talk about that a little bit. Oftentimes I refer to this as, the good old days, when we were locked out and we were basically made to feel as though we certainly did not belong there, and made to feel that just by asking to have the equal ability to do our job, that we were somehow immoral, somehow going to be there because it was great sport to leer at men. There was really not a reckoning with what the reckoning should have been, which was the equality and equal opportunities to do our job. Let me give you an example. I think many of you know that my case went to court in 1978, but my first baseball season as a full-time reporter with Sports Illustrated was the fall, was 76. And in that fall, I was given the assignment to accompany Roger Kahn, obviously an incredible baseball writer, and I learned a lot of stories about the Brooklyn Dodgers on that two-week trip that I made with him. He was assigned to write a feature story on the old-timers. So we kind of plotted our path around to meet the old-timers, and the first one we were going to meet was Bill Veeck, who at that point owned the Chicago White Sox. So I was going to Comiskey Park for the first time with Roger Kahn. So it wasn't until Roger wrote his book, October's Men, in 2003, that I actually understood what had happened to me and to us on the first night that I set foot in Comiskey Park. But let's start in the press box, because Roger went up to say hi to Bill Veeck and was going to go with him to the press box, and he asked me to pick up our credentials and to meet him there. So let's just read a little bit from his book, October's Men, he wrote in 2003. At the press gate, Melissa picked up credentials good for the press box in the field. Mine covered the press box, field, and clubhouse. And upstairs, I sat beside Veeck, who chain-smoked mentholated cigarettes. Melissa parked herself in the second row of the press box and quietly kept score. Some old-line baseball writers variously stared and oogled. I guess that's me. At me. One writer came up and said intensely into my ear, "Your girlfriend doesn't belong here. You know that. What do you think this is? Ladies' night at the Turkish bath?" So, after the game, the idea was that Bill Veeck was going to meet up with Roger and myself in the Bards Room, which was the after-game lounge where the writers would go. It was a rather old brick and kind of mahogany room, and I had a bartender. And so, because we weren't covering the game, we didn't have a story to write, Roger and I got there on the earlier side. And again, let me quote from Roger's book where he wrote about this incident. "A few sports writers glared at Melissa and then at me, and though I knew some of them, no one offered a nod or even a friendly look. It was as though I had brought a harlot into the temple. After a bit, the bartender motioned me aside and he whispered, 'Sir, your secretary will have to drink in the hall.' I snapped, 'She is not my secretary. She's a reporter, and if she has to drink in the hall, I will drink there too.' And with that, we left, and we never had our time with Bill Veeck that night. In fact, Roger had to call him the next morning to ask him to make the Bards Room available for me and Roger the following night. And at first, Bill Veeck said to him, and again, I don't have this whole thing, but it's from the book. Bill basically said to him, I don't run the Bards Room. The writers run the Bards Room, and you know, I can't do anything. And Roger Kahn said, 'Of course you can. You own this ballpark. Of course you can.' And so finally, Roger convinced him to. And later that night, after the next game, in fact, I did sit with Roger and Bill, and I think we closed down the Bards Room at about 2:30 or 3, with me sipping spritzers and the two of them having their chosen drinks. But my job was to keep notes, and so that was my trip to Comiskey Park. So we move into the second of my baseball seasons. That's 1977. You will note that we were still using typewriters in those days. So it really takes us back, doesn't it? So in the 1977 season, I'm based in New York. So and you might remember in 77, the New York Yankees were quite a story. They were a powerful team on the field, but they were much more of a soap opera off it. And they had Reggie Jackson's, you know, the straw that stirred the drink, and of course George Steinbrenner and the tempestuous Billy Martin and the fight in the dugout and in Fenway Park, and a number of things happened that year. And so any reporter worth her salt would want to be inside that clubhouse, which I did. But I never made a point. I was the only one there. You don't, when you're a woman and you're the only one, you try to fit in, not stand out. Just so you guys know what it's like. And so I would work with Mickey Morabito, who was my contemporary. He was the same age I was. He kind of got it. Most of the older PR people did not get it and still didn't want women around. I think they did think that we were going to ruin the sport and somehow ruin their players. Mickey got it, and we held many, many private conversations during that year. And by mid-season, Mickey came to me and he said, I have an idea. And what do you think? His idea was that I would go to the side door of the clubhouse, which you see with his face there, and he would go in the front door where the guards were. The side door was simply locked. I would be at the side door. He would open that door for me, and he would take me into Billy's office. And so I said, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, either I was in Billy's office or I was out, so I'd rather be in. And so that's what I did for the first half of that, last half of that season, which really gave me a pretty good look at what was happening, because a lot of the reporters who went into the locker room would come to Billy's office to bounce off of him what players had just said to them about something, and there was always this back and forth. So it at least gave me that, and it also did another thing that was really important. It made the male reporters comfortable with me taking that first small step, okay? I wasn't barging into a place that they didn't feel I belonged at a time that I didn't belong. But they really got accustomed to the idea that on any given night, I'd probably be on the couch, you know, in Billy's office, right across from his desk, and the men would be walking in and out of the locker room with questions. So that was incredibly valuable. I was very much a gradualist. I often think of myself as a mother, may I, you know, kind of asking for permission to take each step. So here's what happens with that gradualist approach. At the end of the season, for the last two games, Mickey Morabito, without me asking, leaves me two passes for daily clubhouse admission to the Yankees. So this is in 1977, before the World Series, where I get banned from all clubhouses. So the gradualist approach had worked. We'd kept it quiet. No one had made a scene about it. I had not tried to barge in. I had really worked, you know, under the radar. And so he gave me those passes. There were no restrictions put on, but I put restrictions on myself. I did not need to report a story that night for a game story the next day. So I only used the clubhouse admission pass to go in before the game. Now, there should have been no reason that I had not been in the clubhouse before every game that season. During the time between batting practice and when the game starts, no player is changing in any way. No player is showering. They wore their uniforms to hit batting practice. They will wear their uniforms to go out to the game. So what you kept hearing, if you were alive in the 70s and heard anything about this, is that I was going to, of course, leer at naked men. Well, I wasn't going to leer at naked men, even if that was the supposition, before the game. So again, taking the gradualist approach, I used the pass and went in only before those two games. Again, no one wrote a story about it. No one tried to kick me out. No man yelled at me. The players sort of knew me enough by then. They'd sort of seen me around. In other words, it wasn't a big deal. So we get to the World Series. I'm also in the locker room during the American League Championship games when the Yankees are at home. So we get to the World Series, and I go to collect my World Series pass. I'm very excited because I've never been assigned before to cover a World Series. It's my first, and I'm really looking forward to it. And I think, you know, you've done a good job. You've been a gradualist. You kind of made your way through. This is good. You're in a good place. So the Dodgers come to town. I realize the Dodgers have never had a woman who's covered them. And so I take it upon myself to go and hang out with Tommy Lasorda in the beginning, because I knew him from my Roger Kahn trip. And Tommy looks ashen when I mention the fact that I might come into the clubhouse, into the manager's office. Looks ashen and kind of walks away from me. And he says, listen, talk to Tommy John, who's our player rep. And so I do. And Tommy John was incredible. We sat down in the dugout. He looked at my pass. He asked a few questions. And then he said, basically, he said, listen, I might be not uncomfortable. I might not be comfortable with this, but let me take it to a, you know, team meeting. We'll have a meeting, and then we'll take a vote, and let me meet you before Tuesday night's first opening game. We'll meet at the backstop. Let's just, you know, not make a big deal. Let's just see what the players think. So I didn't even mention anything to my editors, and I meet him at the backstop, and he says, hey, it wasn't unanimous, but we had a meeting. And the majority of players said, fine, they understand that you have a job to do, and thank you for letting us know. And I started walking away, and he said, hey. He said, could you do me a quick favor? He said, I haven't talked about this with our PR people. Could you go find Steve Brenner and kind of let him know that this is happening? Well, again, I'm under no obligation to be his messenger, but, you know, again, perhaps being the mother, may I, perhaps being a woman, perhaps being often asked to do tasks for men, I said, fine. So I went to see and found Steve Brenner, who I'd never met before. Again, he looked rather ashen at the prospect of what might happen. So I just went to the auxiliary press box where I was seated, and the game started. And in the fifth inning, I was called up to the main press box. And that's when I was informed by Bob Weirs, who was the head of media for baseball, that, as he put it, permission was never granted. I said, but the Yankees and the Dodgers gave me permission. He said, permission was never granted because the commissioner's the only man who can give you permission, and he won't. And he won't for this series, and he won't as long as he is commissioner. So that was what happened the first game. So in the sixth game of the World Series, by then some conversations and negotiations were going on between the editor of baseball at Sports Illustrated, the lawyers for Time Inc., and the commissioner's office. And I was, of course, not included in any of those meetings, nor was my opinion asked as to what should happen. But I was called about 10 minutes before I was going to leave to take the subway up to the stadium before game six, in which you all know Reggie Jackson hit the 3 home runs and brought back the World Series to New York for the first time in 14 years. The solution that baseball came up with, and I was told I would adhere to for that night, was that I was given an escort, a male escort. It's the only time I've had a male escort in my life, but I was given a male escort, a wonderful gentleman named Larry Shank, who was the PR person for the Philadelphia Phillies. And Larry was told that he was to be the runner for me. I was to wait outside the whatever clubhouse I wanted to meet him at. It turned out, of course, the Yankees. And the quote-unquote separate accommodations that the commissioner would always talk about were that I was pushed up against the concrete wall next to the door leading into the locker room, where I had a very close-up view of all the men who had no credentials who were let into the locker room, where I got to stare at my credential, which said I could go into the clubhouse, and I was kept out with all the fans who were screaming so loud that even if Larry Shank had been able to bring players out to me to talk to, they wouldn't have heard me, and I wouldn't have heard them. As it turned out, he was able to bring out two players who hadn't played in the game for me to talk to. I asked, of course, to speak with Reggie Jackson, who you see here surrounded by all the men in the locker room. And Reggie came out at about, I'd say an hour and 45 minutes later after I'd been standing against this concrete wall, and he said, hey, Melissa, I've basically said all I have to say. I'm headed downtown. That was that. That was my night at Game 6 of the 1977 World Series. So negotiations went on through the fall to try to find some common ground, some solution that would be a little bit different than giving every woman a male escort. That was clearly shown to be ineffective as a way to bring about equality. So here comes my judge. We file a complaint in December of 1977 with the Southern District Court of New York. It's a district federal court. And sitting on that court at the time, and you will see my arrow pointing to Judge Constance Baker Motley, you can see perhaps in that photograph that she is the only woman on that court at the time. In fact, in its 189-year history, as the mother court of our country, the only court founded before the Supreme Court, she was the only woman who had ever been on that court. And that was in 1966 when she was appointed by President Johnson, but it was also true in 1977 and 78 as my case made its way through. You'll see the wooden box that they spin with the available judges' names in them, and the clerk of the court pulls out a random card. And on that card was the name Constance Baker Motley. Let me just give you a little bit of background about her. If you were paying attention to Ketanji Brown Jackson earlier this year when she became the first black woman to be nominated for and appointed to the U.S. Supreme Court, turns out she shares a birthday with Constance Baker Motley. And she made a point both at her announcement at the White House when she accepted the nomination and also in her statement to the committee, the Judiciary Committee. She made a statement in which she said that had the times been different, Constance Baker Motley might well have been the first black woman Supreme Court justice. Constance Baker Motley, among many people she represented, was James Meredith in desegregating Ole Miss. When Thurgood Marshall, who headed the NAACP Legal and Education Defense Fund, got the case for Meredith, he essentially laughed. He said, "This will never happen. This will never happen." And he threw the case to Constance and said, "You take care of it." He believed that Constance Baker Motley ought to be the ones to argue the cases in the South because he feared that if he sent himself or another black man to the South, that person might be killed. And so Constance Baker Motley spent her time in Southern courtrooms arguing for racial equality. In the proposal for my forthcoming book, I talk about the three main characters in my book. One is myself as the plaintiff, the other is my judge, Constance Baker Motley, and the third character is the 14th Amendment, the Equal Protection Clause. And that clause spanned our lifetimes. Constance Baker Motley used it to a great effect, obviously, in the 10 cases that she, as an African-American woman, argued before the Supreme Court in the 50s and 60s. She won 9 of them outright. The 10th one she later won because the court overturned its own ruling in their case. She was a phenomenal, phenomenal attorney, jurist, and as a judge, her record is an extraordinary one. There's a major comprehensive biography that just came out this year called Civil Rights Queen, which she actually, Tomiko, who wrote it, who's a constitutional law scholar at Harvard, I spent a lot of time with her, gave her the full transcript, gave her lots of papers from the case, and as a result, the one case that she devotes an entire chapter to in that book is the case of my case before Judge Motley. So I didn't know any of this back then. This is pre-Google. I mean, who knew, right? I mean, I didn't know who this remarkable woman was. I mean, my attorney, who was also a very familiar name, I don't think you'll forget this name. His name was F.A.O. Schwartz, Jr. He was the great-great-grandson of the toy store founder. But more importantly, he had just come from being the youngest chief counsel ever on a congressional committee, and that was the Church Committee. And the Church Committee was about privacy and secrecy in our government. He was the one who discovered the counterpoll activities against the women's movement and the Black Panthers. He's the one who uncovered the letter anonymously sent by the FBI to Martin Luther King Jr. advising him to kill himself prior to accepting the Nobel Peace Award. So Fritz came to my case having just spent 2 years doing that kind of work. He was a phenomenal litigator. He's still alive, and I'm happy to say he's one of my closest friends, and he's read every word of my book. So I think that I've got it right in terms of the law. But let's take a look at the cultural moment that this created. Peanuts, Charles Schulz, decided to devote several comic strip series to it. I'll read this one if people can't read it there. So Lucy says, "Hey, manager, I'm a reporter for our school paper, and I demand to be allowed into your locker room for interviews." We don't have a locker room. Well, I don't want to be a reporter anyway. The Tonight Show did a skit. Betty White, I'd like to think, played me, but let's just call it a generic sports reporter. And of course, it ends with Betty White in a towel, and that's what I mean by equality. There was a sense that if you wanted to be equal, well, you should put a towel on or, you know, walk in there without clothes on. Didn't quite get who we were supposed to be equal to. But anyway, here's the typical scene at the end of their skit where she's walking in to get into the shower with Johnny. And on Saturday Night Live, O.J. Simpson was the host that week, so he played the ball player. You can see that the towel is wrapped around his neck, and Lorraine Newman is the sports reporter. So it did become a fairly large-scale cultural moment. But back in Judge Motley's courtroom, it was really a case about equal rights and about the 14th Amendment and Equal Protection Clause, and that's what it was argued on. I will say that for the voluminous coverage that this case received, I was actually a little surprised when not one reporter, not one, showed up for the actual hearing in this case. So that is the part of this story that's never been told, and that's the part that I'm going to now tell in my book. Motley decides this case on September 25th, 1978. She decides in our favor. And I want to be sure you understand that I was not, and we were not, in the case asking to go into locker rooms. We were asking for equal access. It was up to baseball, was a private organization. No court could tell them how to run their media policy. The only thing the court could tell them based on constitutional law was that whatever their media policy was, it had to be equal for the men and the women. So it was never actually a case about going into locker rooms. It was always a case about equal access. This gives you a little bit a sense of some of the headlines that came out when the ruling occurred. I would say that some of the people who were most pleased by this lawsuit were the copy editors at New York newspapers, because they got to play around with every pun they could come up with that had to do with sex and baseball. So that was basically a free-for-all for them. I don't have the best ones from that particular thing with the sexual puns, but I have them aplenty in my book. The only time that the men seemed to understand that the case was about equal rights when they thought that, yippee, if she wins, at least we will be able to go into, at that point, Chrissy Everett's locker room, and, you know, implied that they could then see Chrissy Everett undressed. Well, so what they didn't get about equal rights is that men and women covering tennis already had equal access, because the locker rooms were not where the interviews took place. Okay, so they already had it. The players were brought out into a media availability room where men and women sat together and asked. So that was a very typical refrain of the time. It rarely was challenged, but the men constantly decided that that would be the bonus that they would get from this thundercloud that was coming their way. I'm going to return now to end with mother and daughter. So there's my mother and me soon after my birth. I was born in Iowa City, and we moved to Western Massachusetts, where my father took a job as a professor at UMass Amherst. But I want to go back even further than that, because On the day of, well, 3 days after my birth, my grandfather in back in Massachusetts, the man who had introduced my mother to baseball, who had taken her to Fenway Park as his seatmate for all those years and passed down his love of the game to her, wrote a letter to my mother in Iowa, congratulating her on the birth of her first child. So you'll see the field as it looked when they were there. You'll see the envelope it came in. And I'll just read from my grandfather's letter. First of all, he misspelled my name in the first paragraph, which I don't have here. And then in the second paragraph, he went right into a play-by-play. He said, "Well, we were thinking of you, and in fact have been doing so ever since the event," meaning my birth. "And yesterday, from 1:30 p.m. and on, we were listening to the Red Sox wang the Yanks twice in a row. What a ball game that first one was. 15 innings and some job of relief pitching by Scarborough, he did. When the Yanks came up with those 7 runs in the 7th inning and made the score 6-10 with 2 innings to go, we thought it was about all over. And when Ted Williams hit that home run in the last of the 8th to tie it up, oh, so we thought this time the Yanks were in for a real battle, and they were. They just couldn't get Ted to hit the ball where they were ganged up on him, and he has been hitting a lot to left field in the last 2 weeks, and the Yankees gave up shifting for him, and then he banged him to right and center and all over the place." Anyway, it goes on for a couple more innings. So here she is, you know, just having come home from the hospital. In fact, it turns out that she had been given a spinal, and no one told her that you don't sit up after you've been given a spinal. So she had what she described as the headache of her life. And here she gets this envelope and opens it up, and there's sort of one sentence about congratulations on becoming a mother, and then it's play-by-play of the Yankees and the Red Sox. So I think that when I talk about getting my DNA, you know, at birth for baseball, I think that's true. So baseball daughters and her story. So you'll see the picture of my daughter, Maya, who I adopted from China. And that is at Fenway Park when I introduced her to Fenway Park when she was quite young. And then you will see that I had really a rare opportunity to experience Cooperstown with her, where my two baseball passes, the one from the World Series and the Yankees one, are housed in a display, an exhibit that I saw for the first time in Diamond Dreams. So that came at the invitation of Claire Smith, who about 4 years after I had left baseball, came in as a reporter first with the Hartford Courant and then with the New York Times, and she is the first woman ever inducted into the Hall of Fame and the Writers. And Claire was wonderful enough to invite me to be her guest at that Cooperstown induction. And I said to my daughter, you know, your generation does not have the opportunity that ours did to really experience firsts in a way that we did. And there's something about experiencing that history that's going to stay with you a lot longer than reading about it. And I said, you can either, you know, stay home, be with your friends on the weekend, or you can come with your mother to Cooperstown. And I was just absolutely delighted that she decided to come with her mother. So here we are. That is at her baby shower. And this is for all of those young women who are just crawling now, who soon will be walking, and soon, hopefully, will join with these women who are really making their mark both off the field and on the field. And my final slide there is of Susan Waldman, my great friend and just extraordinary broadcaster. So I'm going to close out now with 2 more slides. I'm going to dedicate my TEDx talk, and this is what I took from my TEDx talk to share with you today, to Katie Casey. And I don't know how many of you know about Katie Casey, but it turns out that we all tend to sing the chorus of Take Me Out to the Ball Game, but I don't think many people know that that song is really written about a woman who loved baseball so much that when her boyfriend said, "Let me take you to a show," she said no. She said no. Take me out to the ball game. And so, in honor of that, I am hopefully, I'm going to have to call on Perry Barber if this doesn't work to sing, but let's see if we can't let, let's see, where are we?
For the hometown crew, every cent that Katie spent on one Saturday, her young beau called to see if she'd like to go to see a show. But Miss Kate said no. I'll tell you what you can do. Take me out to the ball game. Take me out with the crowd.
You guys can sing. Buy me some peanuts and cracker jacks. I don't care if I ever get back, cause it's root, root, root for the home team. If they don't win, it's a shame.
Cause it's one, two, three strikes, you're out at the old ball game. Katie Casey saw all the games, knew all the players by their first names, told the umpire he was wrong all along, and she was strong when the score.
So thank you, Carly Simon.
Do you want to do any Q&A? Okay, unfortunately, are you going to stick around? So that was amazing, wasn't it? Thanks. Thank you, Melissa. And for those of you who missed it, you're going to want to hear that particular talk.